Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to another edition of Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of this show. We are now on our fourth podcast, and the feedback has been great. Thanks to all the listeners who have been sending in emails, giving suggestions, and more. Your comments are greatly appreciated. Please keep them coming. Today's show has quite a lot of material, so my segment is going to be short. Then we'll have a follow-up interview with Keith418, have a very special interview, and then end the podcast with some music. As a result, this podcast is going to be a few minutes over my 60-minute limit. I simply had to make an exception, and you'll hear why a little later. I received an email from Scott V, who asked what Thelemic beginner book I recommend. That may sound like a simple question, but there is no simple answer. Ideally, I would say Magic in Theory and Practice, and Magic Without Tears, both by Aleister Crowley. The reason I say these two is because they have a wealth of information, and it is not presented as easy or dumbed down. Yet, this can be discouraging for some people. I know when I read Magic in Theory and Practice, I understood maybe 2%. The rest went straight over my head. But for me, that was a motivator. It made me understand that this material was not easy, and I strove to understand it more. For others, though, this is discouraging. For these folks, there are a couple of books I recommend. The first is Gerald Del Campo's New Eon Magic, Thelema Without Tears, published by Luxor Press. Okay, I'm a little biased. However, for a beginner's book, this is pretty good and has a good amount of information, as does The Magic of Aleister Crowley, a handbook of the rituals of Thelema by Lon Duquette. All of that said, one note of caution. These books were made to help the Thelemic practitioner get a little understanding under their belt. These are beginner's books. Do not be surprised that in a short period of time you become proficient at the material. This is good, but don't think that this will make you an adept. These books are here to help you get a jump start on the steep learning curve. You will still need to read the Crowley materials and others. I promise you, you'll struggle to understand the material. This work is not easy. This path takes a lot of time and energy. Pace yourself, and be sure you are ready for the long haul. I've been practicing since 1992, and still feel I've only taken a few steps forward. Many try to walk this path, few get far. Be honest with yourself, gauge your interest and willingness to do the work. It is hard, but the path is rewarding for those who put in the effort. Like most things in life, you get out what you put in. I hope that helps you, Scott. Now we'll jump straight into the interview with Keith418. In the second podcast, we were talking about the Thelemic community having property, and in this interview, we continue from there.
Hello, Keith.
Hi, John.
Hey, how are you this evening?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Doing good. Well, in the last podcast that you were on, we ended by speaking about acquiring property, and I was wondering if you wanted to continue on that thread and offer more thoughts about the acquisition.
I was reading stuff about this recently, and I think that one of the things we have to really consider about owning property is that property demands a certain amount of discipline. You can have discipline, self-discipline, group discipline, whatever, and not own any property. But you can't have no discipline and have property. Because property you have to take care of, you have to be responsible for, you have to protect, because there are people that are going to be out there trying to take it away from you. That's what litigation exposure is about. So in order to have property, you have to have self-discipline. You know, if you don't pay your rent every month, you can't have an apartment. If you don't pay your mortgage every month, they take your house away. And the less self-discipline the group has, the less property it has. The more self-disciplined it is, the better the chances that it's going to be able to have the discipline to manage the property and protect it and keep it and even make more of it and grow it. And this is the real challenge because Crowley tells us that Thelema is 90%, and I guess he says it's 90% self-discipline, but we don't see that in the Thelema community. I mean, you have to ask yourself, is the Thelema community a community characterized by its self-discipline? And I don't think anyone in the order would say that. I don't think anyone in the Thelema community would say, yes, an objective outsider coming in would look at our community and say, man, these people are self-disciplined. So in a lot of senses, we have to look at this crisis about the definition of the lemma and self-discipline. I think a lot of people look at the lemma as a way around self-discipline, that they don't have to be self-disciplined, they don't have to quit smoking, they don't have to exercise, they don't have to lose weight, and that's what the lemma is about. Whereas Crowley would say it's the total opposite. So if you don't have self-discipline, you can't have property. And the OTO, or whatever thelemic organization you want to talk about, lack of property, both on an individual level and on a group level, is really tied, I think, to its lack of self-discipline.
Well, okay, so if we have a group of individuals who are lacking self-discipline, how do you explain that there are a few organizations with either rented, I don't know of any but that own property, but, you know, a few OTO bodies own property, rent property.
Well, I think that's a positive step. And we've seen that it's very, very difficult to keep a consistent community going in people's houses. It just doesn't work. The person who owns the house or owns the property has this huge onus of responsibility on them, and they get burned out and frustrated by it. I mean, I've heard people complaining that, oh, you know, these weirdos come to my house and then things go missing. I've had, you know, a body master complain to me about things constantly being pilfered from their house. This isn't unusual, unfortunately. So the OTO has looked at this, and other thelemic organizations look at this, and they say, hey, you know, we have to rent the property because there's serious problems when it just devolves down to the one person who's letting the activity go by at their house. So across the country, we've seen people more or less sort of biting the bullet and renting property, and they have tremendous problems with it. They can't raise the money to keep it going. It's always touch and go. There's not a funding mechanism to make sure that it gets paid for. Local dues are very controversial. You know, people struggle to get the money in and to convince their members that they need to pay for it. Meanwhile, a lot of people who, you know, don't understand why they need to have this rental property keep saying, well, why can't we just go back and do it in the living rooms again and save all this money and not have to pay the dues?
One of the things I find interesting is being in Atlanta, there's a large predominance of churches and a large predominance of very small non-denominational Protestant churches that are funded by lower socioeconomic people, both African American and
poor neighborhood after poor neighborhood has little churches, and you know what else they have? Little Masonic fraternity halls. I mean, right around the corner from me, there's a little African American Masonic hall. There's another one, you know, maybe a mile away. I see these all the time. Now, these are some of the poorest, most marginalized people in our community. They're in a ghetto situation. And yet they have churches, they have their Masonic bodies. They're not meeting in people's living rooms. So if they can do it, why can't we?
Well, some people would argue that they have to do it because if they don't, they'll go to hell.
Right. I think that those people are, frankly, idiots. That sort of comment indicates a complete lack of knowledge and a patronizing condescension towards people in these communities. I mean, my parents' Quaker meeting, none of the people there believe in the whole concept of hell. They're very close to Thelema in that they say God speaks to every individual. They have a minimal amount of dogma. They have a consensus-making decision process, but they all have property. There's a Quaker meeting right up in Berkeley. There's probably a few in Atlanta. Wouldn't surprise me at all. They have schools.
Yes.
Chelsea Clinton went to a Quaker school. My mom went to a Quaker boarding school. They don't believe in hell. What you have to look at is that these people believe not in a negative sense in their religion, but in a positive sense with it. It does something for them. It fulfills them. They're deeply committed to it. They're not afraid of going to hell. They attend Masonic meetings and church meetings and activities because they enjoy them and it's a part of their lives. It's essential.
Well, you could also draw parallels from that to the Buddhist community.
Of course. Do the Buddhists believe in hell?
No.
Okay, so are they all building temples all over the United States because they're terrified of going to hell and that they're enslaved to some dogmatic system?
No, not at all.
Of course not. So the Thelemites that are telling us this obviously don't know anything about these other religious and fraternal groups.
Or they're using it just as a cop-out or an excuse.
It's a stupid cop-out. It's a stupid and condescending one.
So how do you think we got here? I mean, what do you think is motivating people to have these kind of cop-outs or attitudes?
Well, I think it's a number of things. I mean, part of it is that deep down, I think a lot of people are very conflicted about their own relationship to Thelema. They're frightened of it. They're worried about groups like the OTO or whatever they're involved in becoming a cult. And if they take it seriously, they think, then it could be something that will bother them or create a problem. That they may be worried that they're working to create a Jonestown situation. And the only way they can kind of keep that from happening is by making a minimal commitment, by not taking it seriously, by joking about it a lot, and making sure that it doesn't consume a huge amount of sacrifice from them. So if they act really disciplined about it and really focused on it and take it as seriously as the other groups do, it creates something that they're terrified of.
What are some of the other reasons do you think this happens?
Well, I think a lot of it is that their expectations are low because the rest of their lives are perhaps not informed by goals and achievement and everything else, that they're looking for a kind of respite from challenge rather than a place to challenge themselves. And if you have an egalitarian attitude, you can't really challenge the people you're working with to get away from that kind of attitude, because their opinion, no matter how poopy it might appear to you, can't be challenged. It's just as good as yours. So it's very difficult to lead people away from that.
Hmm.
I mean, how can you, if you really want to own property, tell somebody who doesn't want to exercise the self-discipline it's going to require that they need to do it? If you don't really know what your will is, and you think that Thelema forbids you from imposing your will on anyone else, how can you lead the community to something better? You end up caving to the lowest common denominator.
Right. We see that quite often in the Thelemic community.
Right. And why is that? Because I think people are terrified of the real implications, and they need to work on that. They need to have a confrontation with that. And rather than confronting their fears, they're too busy laughing at the organization and distancing themselves from these kinds of confrontations to even look at it clearly. You know, I mean, I think that's the real tragedy. And I think a good thing is that these dues confrontations and the confrontations over rental property and everything else are sort of forcing people to look at how serious they're really going to take it.
In the last podcast, when I was speaking to Richard Kaczynski, we briefly talked about educational levels of the members within the Thelemic community. Do you think that has anything to do with this?
Well, I think one of the things you want to look at is, do people own their own homes? Because most of the time in middle-class America, if everyone owns their own home and they're part of a religious community, that community has property. That's not uniformly the case, because, you know, some renters are going to contribute to a church that owns property. But in general, your expectation that you're not going to make a landlord rich, that you're going to build equity for your church or whatever, is just going to be there. So I think, you know, education is tied to class issues. We need to look at that. But there's a whole bunch of different problems and issues that come into education within the Thelemic community. Because on the one hand, if you're educated enough to be middle class, what you're educated in are the ethos and morals of middle class life, which find, frankly, the Thelemic material frightening and threatening. Right? If you're not educated, if you're coming from a lumpen background or you're working class, you don't have a lot of college, maybe you're a high school dropout, maybe you have a criminal record or background, maybe you're just, you know, not very well educated, then it's going to be hard for you to approach the Crowley material, because it was written by a very well-educated person, you know, a long time ago when standards for literacy and everything else were very different. And it's hard for some college-educated people to go back and read the Equinox and Crowley's original writing. It's going to be that much harder for you if you don't have a college education. So we're kind of trapped either way. If we have a lot of well-educated middle-class people, their value system, the value system that got them to be well-educated and middle-class in the first place, is going to reject a lot of the thulemic material. And if they don't have that background and they don't have that training, they're not going to be able to approach it because they haven't been trained in the tools to understand it.
So how do we get past this?
Well, we have to recognize that that's a problem. And currently, the community is too busy telling itself that it's not a problem, that Thelema doesn't have any conflicts with bourgeois morals and values, which Crowley clearly said over and over again that it did, or that you don't have to be really well-educated to understand some of this difficult material, and that the material you don't understand could be important. I mean, a lot of times people have this reaction, well, if I don't understand it, then it's not important. Well, no. The stuff you don't understand could be really important, and you need to understand it.
Well, do you think that's where many of these beginner books come in to help speed people
they're
up
an
to
attempt,
this?
They're an attempt to kind of address that problem. And unfortunately, it's not working. It's not sufficient. The beginner books are, for the most part, a joke. They minimize the threatening and difficult material. They confuse simple for easy when simple can be very difficult. The most difficult things can be simple. So, no, you know, I don't think that that's a solution. But I've often compared this to a situation in a country like China. Now, if we lived in China, the people who spoke English well enough to translate the Equinox from English into Chinese would be wealthy. And there'd be a difference between them and the people that they'd be translating for. This would create a divide, you know, and there'd be conflicts across that divide. The people dependent on the translators, the people trying to control the direction of the community through the translation, et cetera, et cetera. You can kind of play that out in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got the same situation now in English, because we have people that can understand Crowley in the original, think it's important, can tackle the difficult material. And then you have the people who are just not educated enough to do that.
And so they end up getting the beginner's books, i.e. the translations, and then the translators or the authors of the beginner's books end up orienting the people who are reading the beginner's books and not the original material.
Right, or they try to. Or they do the beginner's books with an attitude of leading the people they're writing them for and say, hey, I can give you this direction. I can insert myself or, you know, interpolate the material for you, if that's the word I'm looking for, I don't know. But that's the problem. So, you know, to me, if you're comfortable with just a beginner book, you've already lost. And if you think you can write a beginner book when you haven't understood the hardest material Crowley's written and mastered it, you're insane. But again, the egalitarian impulse in the United States is to say everyone can get this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, a lot of people are going to be attracted to it and will not get it. They will not master it. They will not attain with it. And that's something we have to confront, too. And that goes against the grain of the American spirit and our egalitarian morality, which is that if everyone can't get it, then there's a problem with it. I mean, this is the resentment I think you see directed at Crowley, that if I don't understand it, it's not my problem, it's his problem. He didn't make it easy enough for me.
Well, we're running out of time, so I think this is a good place to stop, and we can probably pick up from here on the next podcast.
Okay.
But I appreciate your time and appreciate you being on this podcast.
Happy to be here.
All right, talk to you later.
Take care.
Now we come to a very special interview. Over the years, there have been a number of significant figures in the history of magic in Thelema. People like C.F. Russell, J.F.C. Fuller, Jack Parsons, W.B. Crowe, Alan Bennett, and of course Aleister Crowley himself. In my opinion, though, second in importance to Crowley is his magical son, Frederick Codd, or Charles Robert John Stansfield Jones. When speaking about Crowley, there is an abundance of information about his magical work as well as his personal life, yet we are lacking the latter from a Codd. Jones was a prolific writer of diaries in his journal. Even edited, it's over 500 pages. Yet in all that, we have very little about his personal life. We have a Codd the magician, but not Jones the person. All this is about to change, though. The following interview is with a Codd's son, Anthony Stansfield Jones, who is now 70 years old. In this 40-minute interview, Tony takes us back to 1940 and growing up with his father, Fredar Cod. Now, I must warn you, this interview is not about magic, Thelema, or the OTO. It is about growing up as the son of one of Thelema's most important figures. You'll hear about Tony's memories of his parents, how life was in Deep Cove, British Columbia, the kinds of trips he took with his father, and the people who came to visit the family. In short, you'll learn information about a cod available in no printed source anywhere. Thelema Coast to Coast worked closely with Jimenez Beta to make this possible, and is indebted to both HB and Tony for this unprecedented interview. I hope you enjoy listening to Tony as much as I enjoyed interviewing him. So now sit back and listen to a bit of magical history with the son of Fredar Cod, Tony Stansfeld Jones.
Welcome, Tony. My name is John Crow, and before we get going into the interview, let's get some of the family members that we're going to be talking about. Your father, Charles Robert John Stansfeld Jones, also known as Fredar Cod, the magical son of Aleister Crowley, born in London, England, on April 2nd, 1886. Your mother, Prudence Rubina Stansfeld Jones, usually going by the name Ruby. Your full name is
I would say on that, I think she used Prue.
Prue?
She used Ruby.
Okay, Prue.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
we'll refer to her as Prue through the discussion.
Yeah.
And then your full name is Anthony Francis Stansfeld Jones. You go by the name Tony.
Right.
And your sister is Deidre Georgina Stansfeld Jones, or she
Deirdre,
goes by
yeah.
Dee. I'm sorry?
Deirdre.
Deirdre, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. But she goes by the name Dee or Did.
D-E-E.
D-E-E.
Yeah.
And approximately when did she pass away, do you know?
1969.
Yeah. Okay. And when did your father pass away?
In 1950. In February, I think it was the 24th.
Okay.
And my mother passed away in 79.
79. Okay.
Yes. Now, I'm not sure if it's 79 or 80.
Okay.
That would have been in the fall of the year.
In the fall. All right. Now, as we previously discussed, there's a lot of information that your father recorded about his magical work and his interactions and correspondence with various students and teachers, including Aleister Crowley. But one of the things that I, through reading through various documents and correspondence of his and his journals and so forth, he doesn't talk much about his family life. And so I was hoping that you could fill us in and let us know what growing up with your father was like and his habits and how the family got along and things of that nature.
Well, in my very, very young days, I did not know the difference between our family life and, say, a normal family life where the father was there all the time. My dad spent numerous hours in his room doing his thing. Although, he did come down for meals, and we'd sit as a family. But usually families were together most of the time. My dad spent many hours in his own room doing his thing. And he was a good father. I never had any problem, with him. He did when the occasions arose. Did things with me, like we'd do things as father and son. Different trips that we took, short trips, not long trips, day trips and that. And as far as I know, he was a good provider. Us children never really went that short, although it was depression time. They seemed to have a few dollars. Now, my mother took in foster children, numerous foster children, I guess for all my life, in a way to make money to keep the household flowing with what my dad brought in from, I would imagine, lectures that he used to fly off to Chicago and Detroit and have lectures on his works and selling of the books. And Dad did odd jobs in the community, like that's where he met Malcolm Lowry in what do they call it when you sign up for elections, whatever. When you're getting a voter's list together, I forget it. So, and other things that he did, to bring in the cash flow. Which brings me to another point, that I was a foster child until such time as I was 7. And then Mom and Dad adopted. I was one of the 8 ward of the courts, the AIDS Society, along with numerous other, and it was run through the Catholic Children's AIDS Association in B.C. here. I remember quite a few, the children that Mom had as a foster basis. And, I mean, even after I was adopted, she was still taking foster children. And I think she had, one time I heard, in the neighborhood of 20 altogether, different times, foster children.
Right.
And my sister worked. She worked for Revenue Canada. And my poor sister, when she was very young, had a serious disease, and they gave her a medication to slow her down, slow her system down, and she never did come back up to normal speed. But yet, good at her job, as far as I know. She was there for many, many years. As a matter of fact, she was still working when she passed away of cancer. And, but really, in the family, Mom was the backbone. Dad was there, but not like families today where they, when Dad got home from work, they're all together doing things as families. We never had that much with Dad. As I say, he was up in his room doing his thing.
Did he ever explain what he was doing or anything of that nature to the children?
Well, not directly to us, but say at the table, when we were all sitting around the table, he would be talking things over with Mom that was going on in his life and what he was doing. And we were just there listening. He never really discussed anything with me, what was going on. Now, whether he did with my sister, who was many years older than I was, I don't know. But usually it was just him and Mom talking about, what was going on. And I think a lot of the conversations we had at the tables was my dad discussing what was going on with Mom to get Mom's feedback on it. My dad relied very heavily on Mom to make sure that he wasn't, that everything was right before he published anything or did anything. He was very methodical in that way.
Did she proofread a lot of his work?
I understand she proofread all his books. That's what I have been told.
And she also was practicing some sort of spirituality or magic or of that nature. Isn't that correct?
Yes, she was, but not to the extent that my dad was.
Did the family get raised in any particular religion? I know you're saying you were raised as Catholics.
We were raised Catholic. My mother was they joined the Catholic Church, I believe, in 1929, Mom and Dad. And my mother was very, very, very strong Catholic. I can't really tell you from how strong my dad was in the Catholic Church at the time when I was growing up. But, I mean, he was at church and that sort of stuff. But other activities with the church, like house, as a matter of fact, when in Deep Cove, because there was no church. And Mom made sure that the linens and all this was properly done, and, you know, had lots of conversations with the priest what was going on. Now, I can't remember my father being that much involved in the Catholic Church. He was a Catholic, but as far as involvement goes, I honestly can't remember. But my mom was. My mom and my sister were devoted Catholics.
So when you had Mass at your home,
yes,
many people from the community came to your home there, also?
When they started that, there was probably about, a maximum of 10 people. Now, we're talking about Deep Cove, which was nothing at that time. What Deep Cove was, when they bought out there, bought the summer cottage, there was no road out to Deep Cove. They had to go by ferry, the old scenic boat, which was owned by Harbor Ferries. And when they bought the place. Now, when they moved out there, I was 6 weeks old, so that would be in 1934. There was a road. Now, today it would be a goat path, but there was a road out there. And then people slowly started to drift into Deep Cove to live full time.
Okay.
But and that was when Mom started the Catholic Church. There was two steps up into the dining room in our house, the living room on the bottom, and then these two steps up. She used to set up her dining room table up in the dining room as the altar and have everything, and then down in the front, or in the living room, was where the congregation sat. And they used the stairs for, you know, to kneel in front of the altar, this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it went on like that for years. And then when there got quite a few more Catholics in the area, then they had Mass said in the community hall. They started using the community hall. And they used the community hall until, oh my goodness, I was out of school when they built the first church in that area, and it was actually in the Seymour Heights area. So that's about as far as I can go on that story.
When your father was in his room, either writing or doing his practices, do you remember ever hearing anything of that nature?
No. We were on the lower floor, and he was upstairs. His bedroom was upstairs. I don't. Periodically, when he was doing something with his thing, and he was chanting that, yes, we could hear it downstairs, but you couldn't really make out what was going on. And there was people that came from Vancouver to Deep Cove, because he had some members, I believe, of the society in Vancouver. One that I remember quite well was Helen. Now, I don't know if this was her first name or her last name. They used to come out. There was quite a few people, and I really didn't know the names of these people. One name that I do remember was a fellow by the name of Bill Shoebottom. They used to come out and go up to Dad's room, and they'd just be up there and do their thing. Now, whether Mom knew what they were doing up there, I have no idea. But this Bill Shoebottom was a genius, an absolute genius. And eventually he cracked and went crazy. This man would recite you the Bible backwards. But then there was this author that lived in a squatter shack in Dollard, by the name of Malcolm Lowry and his wife Marjorie. My dad came quite friendly with them, and Malcolm Lowry was in with Dad on whatever Dad and Malcolm did. Malcolm spent more time, actually, with the family, like my mother and my sister and me. And a lot of times Dad would be there too, but just chatting and that sort of stuff. And my dad put Malcolm Lowry's book, Under the Volcano, I don't know if you've heard of it. He put it in book form, because what Malcolm did, Malcolm just wrote. And Dad put it in paragraphs, chapters, this sort of stuff for Malcolm Lowry.
And you used to also go to Malcolm Lowry's place?
Oh, yes. Numerous times I went down with Dad. We would go and go down to Malcolm's. There was a trail from the main highway in the dollar store. You went straight down to Malcolm's squatter shack. There was quite a few squatter shacks down there. And numerous times we went out in Malcolm's little rowboat, did some fishing, and used to go across the bay, Indian Arm, to an island there where Malcolm used to like going over all the time, and we'd have a lunch or something like that, come back, and Marjorie would always have tea on and cook and this sort of stuff. And numerous occasions I went to, with my dad, he'd say, I'm going to Malcolm's, do you want to come? You know, just like a family. And not all the time I went, but a lot of times I did. I couldn't tell you how many over the years.
Now, you said you also spent, you spent your dinners with your father. Would he also spend the other meals with the family?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yep. We always had meals together. A lot of times breakfast was a different story. Like when I was going to school, we had to leave for school fairly early. And sometimes Dad wouldn't be down for breakfast with us. I'm sure he came down later, but not all the time. There was lots of times, though, that Dad did not come down for breakfast. But when I was home from school, not on the weekend, we had lunch together and always supper together.
Did your father help you with your studies?
With my studies?
Yes.
Between my mother or my sister. Usually it was my sister that, like after supper, Mom was busy dishes and this sort of stuff. And my sister, if I had a problem, generally it was Dee that would help me out. And then after supper, I would say most of the time, we would sit in front of the fireplace. And as a family, like the four of us, would sit and just general chat of what I did in the day and my sister did in the day and Mom and Dad. You know, my dad was always off to his room early in the evening. Like, even as a kid, I don't remember what time it was, but I know because I had school, I had to go to bed at a reasonable hour. And I'm pretty sure always Dad was away off to his room before I went to bed.
Now, would he stop and come and put you to bed or any kind of family things like that?
Generally say goodnight to us all. My dad was not a hugger or a kisser or anything like that. I can't tell you that how many times, and it wasn't that many, that I saw my dad actually put his arms around my mother and kiss her goodnight or my sister or me. It was very, very seldom.
So he wasn't affectionate with anybody in the family?
Not overly, no. And I remember on numerous occasions where we'd be, say my dad and I, just sitting in front of the fire, maybe not having conversation, maybe he was reading his book or whatever, and my mother would be out in the kitchen cooking. She was a wonderful cook, my mother. And the fire would go down, and he'd holler at my mom in the kitchen. Mommy, he called her Mommy all the time. Mommy, it's getting cold in here and the fire's going out. And my mom would have to come from the kitchen and put wood, and it was stacked right beside my dad. Yeah, it's one of his quirks, I guess, eh? But all in all, you know, we had no family problems. I can never remember my mom and dad ever having an argument or a fight. You know, I mean, it just wasn't done in those days, I guess. And never, I got into some trouble, and I got a few tongue lashings and even a couple of whippings from Dad because I did things that I shouldn't have. And I remember very vividly that I got when he actually took a stick to me is I took a bird's nest out of a tree. And that, Dad was an owner. And that is, I guess, the worst spanking I ever got. And he did. He took a piece of kindling wood and whacked my butt with it. But he was easy to get along with, you know. Like I was, as a kid, got into lots of scrapes, and he would have the time to explain where I went wrong, you know, and I shouldn't do it, and, you know, and that sort of stuff. But taking a bird's nest out of a tree, oh, that was serious.
Did he explain why that was so bad?
I can't remember whether he did explain to me that it was bad, or he just, in his way, kind of flipped out because, and I brought the bird's nest into the house, you know. And I guess he asked me, where'd you get that? I said, oh, I took it out of the tree. Well, end of conversation there.
Did it have any chicks or eggs or anything in it?
It had eggs in it, yeah. But, our growing up was good. I have no complaints whatsoever.
Do you have any stories or anything, you know, any particular times that you went out or were hanging out or anything that you could remember?
Well, you know, as I say, even after the road went into Deep Cove, it carried on up to Indian Arm, to Indian River. There was a lodge up there, the Wigwam Inn. And the boat came into Deep Cove to the wharf, the government wharf there. And I remember one time I asked my dad, I said, how come, or whatever, why the boat didn't go back? Because it came in one way and kind of went out the other way, eh? And he says, well, it goes on up to Indian River. From here, it's got three or four more stops. You stop at Woodlands and two or three other little places on up the bay, eh? And he says, tomorrow we'll get on the boat and we'll go and see where it goes and see the end of Indian Arm. You know, just spontaneous, just like that. Because I asked him a question, and he didn't know either. He'd never been right up to the Indian River, up to the Indian Arm. And when I asked him, I guess it stirred his curiosity, and he says, tomorrow we'll catch the boat, and we'll see where it goes. And we did. The next day we're on the old Scenic, up the harbor, up the inlet we went.
And so you went on the boat, and you were just watching the scenery or chatting? Or?
Oh, mainly, yeah, I guess we were chatting and looking at the different little islands up there, and, you know, like a stop at Woodlands, Brighton Beach, and a few other spots, you know, and I guess we were talking about these other little places, hamlets up the inlet, and, you know, it was, we were gone most of the day, yeah.
And the ferry took you back also?
Oh, yes, it brought us back to Deep Cove, yeah. If we hadn't been on the boat to, you know, I don't know if it stopped on its return trip or not. I believe it did before there was a road in there.
Mm-hmm.
But once the road was in, I think it just stopped on the way up. I'm not sure if it stopped every time coming back, but because Dad bought a ticket from there to the end and back to Deep Cove, then they came in and dropped us off.
Now,
and I know during the war, Dad was with the ARP, Air Raid Patrol, and that. And a scare came sometime during the war about the enemy dropping seeds or something for poisonous mushrooms. And Dad spent a lot of time out in the woods behind us because it was all forest in behind us, trees and that, eh?
Right.
I remember him spending quite a bit of time out there trying to find these poisonous mushrooms. Now, what he'd have done if he'd have found one, I have no idea.
But he never did find any.
Not that I know of. Well, I think it was a scare tactic. I don't think anybody found any of these poisonous mushrooms. Because I know in school we were told if we were out, because in behind the school was also bush day, and if we were out there and there was anything that looked like a mushroom, we were told to leave it alone on account of these poisonous mushrooms. But I know he spent lots of time out behind the house and that, looking for these poisonous mushrooms. But I don't remember him finding one. At least he never said he did.
Well, other than looking for the poisonous mushrooms, did he spend a lot of times in the wood by himself or with other people?
No. Dad didn't go out wandering around in the bush much at all.
Uh-huh.
He be in Vancouver, eh? Because right. He had quite a few contacts and that in Vancouver that he used to go over and visit with, eh? It's, as I say, the only one that I can remember was a woman that was, her name was Helen. Now, whether it was her first name or last name, I can't remember. And I remember Mom used to talk about her, too, once in a while. And, not in a positive way or a negative way. She just would talk about Helen.
And Dee and your mother got along very well?
I think so. I don't think they ever had. She used to come out, too, and spend hours up in my dad's room. And she'd leave. She was in the same as Dad was, eh?
So they did a lot of work together in his room, your mom and dad?
Yeah, I would say they were up there. I don't know what they were doing up there, to be honest with you, but reading or... I have no idea.
And
I was never in Dad's room until after Dad died. And it was very seldom, I think, my mom went up there. Looked after it. He used to bring his linen down. Mom would wash that, and he'd take it back.
Did your mother and father sleep in separate rooms?
They slept in separate rooms all of my life. I don't really know the reason for it, why, but no. All of my life, they slept. My mom and my sister shared a room down on the main floor, and me and some of the other foster children, we had another room in the house.
And was that on the main floor or the second floor?
That was on the main floor as well. Yeah. And when my father died, when he was buried in the plot, when my sister died, mom insisted that my sister was buried next to my dad. And then when my mom died, she wanted to be on the other end. Eh? And her reasoning for this was, I didn't sleep with the man in life. I'm not going to sleep beside him in death. Yeah. And that's the way it was. My dad, my sister, and my mom. Because it came up, why is Dee going there? Why aren't you? And she said, nope. Dee can be buried there. And then me.
And when
that was her reasoning for it. And there wasn't too many people that argued with my mother. She was a very strong person.
After your father died, how did your mother and sister and yourself take it? Was it a very emotional, very traumatic
experience?
Yes, there
was a lot of emotion in it. And they didn't really show much of it around me, except that I, you know, all of us were emotionally upset when Dad died, because it was quite sudden, eh? Like he was fine and he caught a cold waiting for the bus. It turned to pneumonia in 3 days. He was gone. And Mom's answer to that, you see, Dad was looking for the truth in religion and that. That's why they went to Catholic religion, because Dad says that's where the truth is, Mommy. So they went to the Catholic religion. And Mom figures that Dad got too close to the truth, and the Lord took him. That was her story on why Dad took sick and died 3 days. He was gone. And as you state in your book there, I've read part of a bit of it. Dad did. He seemed to always have a cold, which he said that he was prone to cold. And I know he never really sick to the point where they had to go to the doctor or hospital, but seemed to always had a cold.
Now, you said after he died.
Now, what, after which?
You were able to enter his room. What was his room like?
Oh, it was fine. It wasn't a cluttered mess or anything like that. There was stacks of papers and books and that. But the room was not, untidy. Not at all. Except for he had lots of papers and books up there. It was full. But he had lots of bookshelves and that up in his room.
A lot of the documentation that we have from your father is typewritten, right? So I can imagine a lot of his time he was spent in his room typing out letters or essays or his journal.
Yeah, and I
so
think
forth.
Most of his diary work was typed too, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. The old typewriter that he had, it was an old Underwood portable. Royal Underwood, something like that, anyway. And I do believe that he brought that typewriter from him, with him, when he came from England. And my daughter has it. It's still in the family.
That's great.
Yeah. I don't even know if you can get those ribbons for him anymore. It was in its own case, just like a little suitcase. And that's the typewriter he used for all his typing. And I do believe he brought that over from him in the 20s from England.
Now, do you know why he went from England to Canada?
I do not know that.
No. And did he meet your mother in Canada? Or do you know the circumstances on how they met?
No, I don't. When they met, they were married in England. They came over as a couple. And I do believe that I've heard somewhere that they actually went to the States first. Now, whether they were in New York, Chicago, Detroit, I do believe that I've heard somewhere that they did settle first in the States and then moved to Canada. And when they came to Canada, they were in British Columbia. I do not know of them living anywhere else in Canada. I know they made a couple of trips back to England after they had settled over here because of my sister. I know they'd taken my sister on a couple of trips back to England. That was before I was born, of course. But they seemed to always come back to British Columbia.
Throughout your life, have you been in contact with your relatives in England?
Just two cousins of my mother's. I haven't been in contact. And since my mother died, I have lost contact. As a matter of fact, I think before Mom died, both Dean and I had passed away as well. They were from Brighton in Sussex. And they had been over twice, twice, and visited Mom. And because I know I was old enough then to have a car, and took them on trips. We were over the island, and quite a few little trips. I took them in my car, so I was old enough to drive.
After your father died, did your mother continue with a lot of the practices and things of that nature, private? Would she go in her room for long periods of time?
No, not really.
But she did stay active with the Catholic Church her whole life.
Oh, she stayed active in the Catholic Church till the day she died.
And yep. And they gave her a Catholic funeral and everything of that?
Yes, they did. Yeah, a fine mass. Two priests. The priest that was at the church, you know, he was the priest for the church, and there was another priest that was here for quite a while that Mom was quite fond of, by the name of Hank Bader. Mm-hmm. And Hank Bader was one of the first priests that came and was the priest of the church when they were in the house. And she contacted him, and he came over, and the two priests did her funeral. It was well attended, the funeral.
Now, you said you were adopted when you were an infant or when you were older?
They got me from birth. I don't know how many days or whatever, because I know that they told me that I was 6 weeks old when they moved to Deep Cove, and they adopted me when I was seven. And I really don't know the reason, out of all the foster children that they had, why they adopted me. I'm not sorry, you know. Mm-hmm. I had a good life, but they just decided to adopt me.
But Dee was a biological child of your mother and father.
My sister was adopted as well.
And they had no biological children?
No. They, my sister was found on Georgia Street in a vacant lot in Vancouver. And she went to the Catholic Children's Aid, and they called her Deirdre. And the Georgina was because she was found on Georgia Street in Vancouver. And in those days, there wasn't the adoption legislation or whatever that there is in the the later days, they took her and signed a paper with the Children's Catholic Aid that they would supply her with food, shelter, and that for as long as need be.
Right.
And that's all there was. And they took her out of the country. Like, my sister lived in Chicago for a short time with them, and they took her to England and all this sort of stuff. Whereas me, I was through the government adoption.
Can you think of any other stories or anything else that would be interesting to know about your family relationship or your parents interacting, or any stories about your mother and father, or between you and your father, any places that you went or anything that you did?
You know, John, I think we've pretty well covered it.
All right.
You know, we're going back 65 years.
Right.
No, 55 years. I'm 70.
Right.
And I was just a kid, you know, most of the time of this. And, you know, actually, what I remember is quite good. You know,
yeah, it is.
Yeah. And as I say, it was a different family relationship as you have today. You know, like, not with my mother and my sister and I, but with Dad, because he spent so much time up in his room. He spent a lot of time with us. I'm not saying that he never, you know, had anything to do with any of us. But he had his thing to do, and he spent a lot of time. And you can imagine from his manuscripts and that, the hours that he put in his room doing this stuff.
Absolutely.
You know, and, but there isn't anybody that could say that I or my sister had a problem with the family.
Mm-hmm.
Because if anybody said that, they're lying.
No.
I had a good bringing up, and people have asked me, have you ever tried to find your biological parents? I said, why would I? This is my mom and my dad. I've had a good bringing up. Why would I want to spoil it? And I never did look them up.
I really appreciate you taking the time. As mundane as these things sound, I think they add a lot to kind of the legacy and information about your father, you know, because all we have is the correspondence that he had with individuals like Crowley.
Yes.
And a lot of his students in the Universal Brotherhood and other organizations, other people that interacted with him, and they have their own journals or letters and correspondence and things of that nature. But, you know, a lot of that is missing.
Yep.
The person, you know,
yeah.
the family man, and, you know, he did not write in his journals much about going out and fishing with you or, you know, taking the ferry or things of that kind.
I don't remember ever going fishing with Dad.
I thought you said earlier that you would go out.
No. But we used to go down to Malcolm Lowry's, and
uh-huh.
he had a little old rowboat, and we used to go out and catch rock cod. And Dad was there with Malcolm. Like, there'd be the three of us. There'd be my dad, Malcolm Lowry, and me in this rowboat. And we used to go and catch some rock cod. But as far as my dad taking me out in the boat, no.
Okay, so you would only go out on those kind of trips with other people, not just you and your father.
No. My dad and I just wouldn't take a boat and go out, well, fishing. But it was one of Malcolm's things over to the island that was in the bay. And then, as I say, we'd sometimes have lunch over there, come back, and Marjorie would always have tea and cookies.
And Marjorie is
Malcolm's wife.
Malcolm's wife.
But my dad and I, to say, go get a boat, go fishing. No, never. But he didn't mind going out with Malcolm, you know, and fish. Yeah.
Well,
but all in all, I had a good life with them, and certainly survived. And, you know, if I had to, John, I would do it all over again, you know.
Well,
I certainly hope our little chat today has helped you and anybody else, and if you think of something down the road, by all means, don't hesitate to phone me and ask me. If I have an answer, I'll give you an honest answer.
Well, this is wonderful. Again, you know, this really adds a lot to the person of a cod. And,
yeah.
And and if anything else does come up, I will definitely give you a call, and I appreciate you the time.
I'd be more than willing to, if I can answer.
Absolutely.
Give you an answer.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I'm glad this is on tape, and my dad, my mother, and my sister were wonderful people. They were. And, I mean, we didn't have too many problems, except my mother had problems with me when I got into my teen years, but...
Well, that's
beside the
point.
That's
pretty normal, actually,
yes.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
But, I'm glad we took the time, John, and as I say, yourself or anybody else that's in the association with what my dad was doing and the association now, like, anybody has a question that they want answered that I could possibly answer, feel free to phone, and if I know, I will definitely give you the answer, because what it is doing, if I do something like this, it is keeping my father alive.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
You bet.
I really appreciate you taking the time, and as we said before, I will be sending you a copy of this recording.
Right.
And also putting one in the archives. And I will be taking a large portion of this and also including it on the podcast or the internet radio project that I do.
Beautiful.
All right. Well, thank you for being on the show, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Tony.
And you know where to get a hold of me.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great.
Bye-bye.
Now.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Tony as well as the rest of the program. Show number 5 should be out in the next 2 weeks. In the last podcast, I talked about the groups Nuit and the Ambient Temple of Imagination. I'm happy to say that I have heard from both and will be incorporating their music into future shows. However, in this show, we have the music of Phosphorus. The opening music, a first on Thelema Coast to Coast, was a portion of his invocation of barbarous names. And our closing music will be the fourth movement of his Manifestations of Nuit. I really like his music and encourage everyone listening to go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and click on the link to his music. There are a number of songs available that are free to download. As I said in the beginning of the show, I appreciate the feedback on the show's blog via email and also the comments on Podcast Alley. The votes I receive there each month help keep the show higher in the list and increase the odds that people will listen. In the next show, assuming all goes well, I'll have my first interview of a person representing a different Thelemic organization and other interesting interviews. Thanks again for listening. Love is the law. Love under will.
I'm going to go to the next one.